We're discussing the role of naturopathic medicine in healthcare on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Kent. Governor Evers signed a bill into law recently that recognizes and regulates naturopathic medicine in Wisconsin, creating two new licensing categories for the occupation and an examining board. Do you see a naturopathic doctor? What is that like? Did it help alleviate pain or other issues? Physicians, what are your thoughts on having naturopathic colleagues? 800-642-1234. Dr. David Kiefer is a clinical assistant professor in the UW Department of Family Medicine and Community Health and the medical director of the Integrative Health Consult Clinic at UW Health. Specializes in family and herbal medicine and ethnobotany. Dr. Kiefer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with hearing how you define naturopathic medicine. What does it mean through your eyes?
Right. What it means through my eyes is in line with what the American Association for Naturopathic Doctors has put together. It's different approaches to health and healing, such as taking a preventive approach to people's health and a do not harm approach, very similar to our medical doctor training, looking for the causes of illness and thinking about treatments that might be useful from an evidence-based perspective. So it feels very holistic, using some of the natural therapies that are out there.
How might it differ then from homeopathic medicine?
Right, homeopathic medicine is a very specific approach to healing using homeopathic remedies. These are, you might see them in health food stores or natural pharmacies, let's say. These are small little, bottles or canisters that have treatments in them of various substances that have been diluted down significantly. They might have an origin in natural products, but it's a whole different category of medicines than what we talk about when we think about naturopathic medicine.
Under what circumstances, then, would you seek out naturopathic medicine? When would you seek it out?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think similar to our consult clinic at UW Health, where we do integrative health, we accept patients that have explored, conventional therapies. They may or maybe looking for something that aligns more with their viewpoint or something that doesn't have as many side effects, let's say, or maybe they've tried all of the recommended conventional treatments and they still have some symptoms. They're looking for something more. And that something more might involve herbal remedies, might involve a deep dive into lifestyle change from exercise or mind-body medicine or nutrition. So you might start to look elsewhere for those therapies, and that might take you to a naturopathic doctor's office.
Can you explain the education and training that comes into being a naturopathic doctor? What does that entail?
Naturopathic doctors, especially the naturopathic doctors that we're talking about that are licensable, that will be able to get a license through this new medical board.
Licensable. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I needed to figure out how to spell that. I must have pronounced it.
We love words here, so carry on.
Yeah, that's a good one. Or maybe we could say medically trained naturopathic doctors. Attended a medical school, and there are several medical schools in North America, two in Canada, and six, I think, in the United States. These are four-year universities. And I taught at one of them for a while when I was living in Washington State, in Seattle, Washington. Bastyr University is its name. So students go through a lot of the same classes that MD medical students go through, from anatomy to physiology to learning about infectious disease and pharmacology. So some of the same classes, and then they branch out and also learn about herbal medicine. They may learn about homeopathy. They may learn about manipulation techniques that might overlap what we know from osteopathic physicians or chiropractors. There are probably elective classes at most of those universities for acupuncture. So learning about all these different possible therapies that in their future practices that they can offer. I was impressed. It's tough to learn the MD medical stuff and then have all of these other topics on board. So it was impressive to see the content that came out of those universities.
What are residencies like then?
Yeah, so residencies, when I was back in Seattle, Washington, say 10 years ago or so, not all students had access to residencies. I'm really not sure what the current situation is for residencies, but many would find a clinic and establish a residency with a practicing naturopathic doctor and work as an apprentice with them for a while. And that was formalized in some cases as a residency and other times as more of a informal apprentice. I think the residency offerings have expanded significantly in order to give those graduate students the chance to really hone their skills.
We're talking with Dr. David Kiefer, who is the medical director of the Integrative Health Consult Clinic at UW Health, specializing in family and herbal medicine. Do you visit a naturopathic doctor? What has that experience been like? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tina is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Tina. What would you like to add?
Well, I just want to say that I lived in Seattle, Washington for 10 years in the 90s and was exposed to Bastyr College. And it was incredible because one of the philosophies as well is that disease and illness takes years of accumulation. And so going to a regular GP for that quick fix or that pill or that surgery is really archaic, that we should really take control of our own lives. Because if it takes years for that disease or that affliction to happen, it takes a long time for it to heal. And I have been looking for that in Wisconsin when I got back. I work at a school district, and preventative care is really just starting here, which I was actually kind of surprised. And I'm actually happy to hear about this because I tend to go that route. I'm more of a preventative person than a curative person, I guess.
Tina, thank you for those insights. Dr. Kiefer, you know, Tina, very much appreciative that this is coming to Wisconsin.
Yeah, I agree. The more healthcare providers that we have working on prevention and helping people to stay well rather than let diseases progress, I think the better. And certainly that falls on the shoulders of my MD colleagues as well. Like, we're all working to, you know, help prevent some of the offshoots of disease and maybe prevent it from starting to begin with. So I think, you know, the more of us that are working in this together in a collaborative way, I think it will help the people of Wisconsin.
Something along the lines that Tina might have gone to is, you know, I've heard that a mark of a naturopathic medicine provider is they spend more time in consultation with the patient than conventional physicians would. Is there anything to that?
I really like looking at the nature medicine principles about identifying and treating the root causes of things. And boy, sometimes it does take time. Like Tina mentioned, if an illness has been brewing for a while or symptoms have been around for a long time, when did they start and how did it get there? And what are some of the exacerbating factors? And I mean, it takes time to get to that. So in a typical primary care model where we don't have as much time to spend with patients, I mean, we can spread that out over time in a continuity fashion, but to sit with someone for an hour, we have that luxury in our consult clinic. And I find things that come up after 50 minutes that wouldn't come up after 10 minutes. So certainly there's an element of being able to have that time to build that provider-patient relationship. I think that's really powerful.
Bastyr University has come up in conversation here, where you're an adjunct faculty. You also have a medical license in Arizona and Wisconsin. How are models of naturopathic licenses different in other states?
Yeah, there's, I think, 20-something states that have licensure for naturopathic doctors. I'm not familiar with all the nuances in those states. What I can say, when I was in Washington, I really liked it. I liked being able to work side by side, in some cases, with naturopathic doctors. And we, you know, each knew the limits of our practices and we could refer back and forth. I'll never forget, there was one of our clinics, actually in my residency clinic, the 45th Street Clinic, which we stayed open one night a week and helped out the homeless youth population. And this boy came in and he had a skateboarding accident, had run into a pole, and it sounded terrible because Seattle's a hilly city. You can get a lot of speed on a skateboard. I'm not much of a skateboarder, but it sounded tough. And his knee hurt. And myself and as a resident at the time, and the attending physician examined him, and he had a clear injury of his ACL. So it was a tough injury, and his knee was really swollen. It looked terrible. So we were going to try to figure out how to get him surgery. But until then, I called in at that time my naturopathic colleagues and their residents and students, and they were able to help him in real time with some treatments to decrease the swelling and help with the pain. And some were the herbal topical treatments, and they may have even been able to do some acupuncture on the spot there. So it was just this neat collaborative model where we each had special knowledge and skills that was able to help a patient. So I envision similar type models here in Wisconsin now that we have the licensure going through.
Thank you for sharing that story. We have family medicine physician David Kiefer with us on the faculty of the UW Integrative Health Program at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Do naturopathic practitioners have a positive impact on the medical community? What questions do you have about it? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about naturopathy and the role of alternative medicine in healthcare on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Governor Evers signed into law recently the creation of a new licensed occupation for naturopathic medicine with licensing oversight by an examining board. How do you feel about this? Do you fully embrace alternative medicine and healthcare, or do you have reservations? 800-642-1234. Family medicine physician David Kiefer is medical director of the Integrative Health Consult Clinic at UW Health with us for about 9 more minutes. Dr. Kiefer, let's dig into a couple conditions to explore. First, I'm wondering about is chronic pain. Can naturopathic medicine help people manage chronic pain without the use of, addictive opioids?
That's a great question, Kate. Thank you. A lot of us are struggling to help people with chronic pain. We see in a collaborative way with patients that might be also seen at the pain clinic at UW, patients in our integrative consult clinic. There are many different modalities that have the potential to work for people that don't involve opioids, and some of those remedies include the herbal medicines that we could kind of review, I guess, if we wanted to. And my naturopathic colleagues are really well versed in knowing about the dietary supplements that could be useful, that may have a more favorable side effect profile, and that can be useful for some folks. There are really interesting manipulative techniques that can work for people that have pain in specific places that some naturopathic doctors know how to use. And so, weaving in a variety of treatments might really be helpful for folks. I look forward to these collaborations to help all of those people out there that still have symptoms of pain despite receiving the most up-to-date conventional treatments.
Another area to explore is cardiovascular disease, because the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians claims on its, Institute for Natural Medicine that they can prevent and treat heart disease, which I believe is a really bold claim when heart disease kills one out of every four people in our country. What do you see there?
Boy, the more people, again, working on that diagnosis, those diagnoses, the better. There are lots of factors that go into cardiovascular disease, from family history and genetics to lifestyle that includes diet and our sedentary society now, that if we have more providers talking to people about those modifiable factors, including nutrition and lifestyle, boy, that would be fantastic. It's not easy to change one's diet. Here in Wisconsin, I grew up here and then was away on the West Coast for a while and came back, and there it's we've got certain food groups here that are emphasized that may not necessarily be the best for our coronary arteries. And so how we can work with patients in modifying that, it can take time. These are ways of eating and part of our culture, and there might be a middle road there that can help to mitigate some of those risks. So I think knowing what I know about the training that naturopathic doctors go through, really they would be a useful resource on the nutritional front, on helping people to understand safe exercise in coordination with the personal trainers and physical therapists that we have out there. So let's get everybody on board and work towards this, and maybe we can decrease those really horrible, I guess, the data that we have about heart attacks and cardiovascular deaths.
Dr. David Kiefer with us, clinical assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, heads the Integrative Health Consult Clinic. You can join in 800-642-1234. Madeline is with us from De Pere. Madeline, hi, what's on your mind?
We have problems with the medical insurance and Medicare refusing to pay for this type of treatment. What can we do about that? Also, Lyme disease is an epidemic in many of our states, and Wisconsin is one of them. We're the fourth in the country with Lyme disease, and it becomes chronic. And you know, we need more to address this horrible condition.
Madeline, thank you. Bringing up two points there. First, though, insurance and who takes it for naturopathic medicine.
Yeah, thanks, Madeline. That one of the toughest parts of my job is with my colleagues reviewing the evidence out there for natural therapies and finding some that are effective. We might find acupuncture or particular herbals or massage therapy that might be useful in some cases, and then we can't get those paid for by people's insurance. Some of that is changing. One of the major insurances in the area is starting to cover acupuncture for some diagnoses, but that's the toughest thing, is to know about an effective treatment and then finding it difficult to get that covered. So I think the first step here, from my understanding of the way that this all works, is make sure that the licensure is in place.
Mm-hmm.
Have a medical examining board that oversees that. And then from there comes insurance coverage for the providers. So it's good for people to have malpractice insurance and the ability to get that. And then hopefully very quickly after that comes, from this recognition that these are useful therapies, that we get some insurance coverage. So I'm with you, Madeline, that if we can get that to happen, that will sure take away some of the financial struggles that my patients have in exploring various integrative therapies.
So right now patients would be paying out of pocket for naturopathic visits mostly?
You know, in Wisconsin, that probably is the case. Let's look ahead to other states, like in Washington state, where naturopathic doctors are licensed and have been licensed for a while and can serve as primary care providers. They were listed on many of the insurance providers out there. So I think that's what we're shooting for. And right now, I think probably it is, I don't want to speak out of turn here, but I think most of that, those treatments are out of pocket at this point.
The Medical College of Wisconsin registered opposition to this law allowing naturopathic physicians to be licensed in Wisconsin. What are some concerns you're hearing out there about starting this licensing in our state?
Some of the concerns I could imagine are originating from just not understanding about the training. And also, I mean, there's a lot of the treatments that that we might recommend even in our integrative health consult clinic that overlap also with naturopathic doctors, that the evidence is there, and we just need to talk about how convincing that evidence is, how safe these therapies are. And sometimes they aren't safe, and we need to recognize the limits of these treatments and when they're appropriate and not appropriate. So as long as we are able to help with my colleagues understanding that is the decision-making that goes into naturopathic treatments, just like in integrative medicine, I think that'll really help. Really helping my colleagues to understand too that there are reputable sources for, let's say, dietary supplements. And that's one of the biggest concerns I hear is about the sourcing and the safety of the supplements that are out there. So that's just symbolic, I think, for understanding what's the evidence, what are the approaches. We're taking a risk-benefit approach to patient care, much in the way that myself as a family physician in a regular medical clinic would take. So the thinking and the approach to patient care is similar. Some of the treatments offered might seem a little bit different from a conventional practitioner. So I hope that answers your question. It's a little tough to explain.
Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kiefer. Dr. David Kiefer, Clinical Assistant Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're learning about how STEM, art, and design influence neurodiverse students. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With funding from a grant through the National Endowment for the Arts, UW-Milwaukee will study the impact of creativity and creative technologies on people with autism. What kind of research do you think should be done in the realm of autism and creativity? How does art therapy affect your loved one who is on the spectrum? 800-642-1234. Mark Fairbanks is co-founder and executive director of Islands of Brilliance. The Milwaukee nonprofit provides learning experiences for children and young adults on the autism spectrum. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Well, could you introduce us to your son, Harry, and how you came to this work to found Islands of Brilliance a decade ago?
Yeah, our son, Harry, was identified on the autism spectrum just before the age of 3. And I think our parent story, my wife, Margaret, and I, is similar to a lot of parents in that we, in addition to the diagnosis, we had the prognosis of all the things he wouldn't be able to do, which we just flat out refused to listen to or believe. So we set out to work with him, and Margaret was great with him. She made everything, all learning activities about his subject matter interest. So he was very much into Thomas the Tank Engine and trains. And as he got older and started using technology, he would hang out with me. I was an art director, creative director in the advertising industry. So I literally gave him 5 minutes of instruction one day in Adobe Illustrator, which is a professional level design software. And a half hour later, he called me back and he had drawn Percy, which is one of the characters in the Thomas universe. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is he had used tools I hadn't shown him. So he's intuitively figured out the software to make stuff that he likes. So then the light bulb goes off. Margaret had gone back and gotten her master's in special ed. And I said, what if we paired kids on the spectrum one-to-one with a design mentor, let them use Photoshop, Illustrator, use their subject matter interest, what kind of special ed support would we need, and what, you know, would that be a program we could develop? And that was the idea for Islands of Brilliance, which we, like you said, we founded 10 years ago.
So, you know, Thomas the Tank Engine and drawing trains in Adobe Illustrator, that was an opening to engage Harry when he was really young. Where do you see the aha moments, the openings now to engage in teenage years? What have you learned through this journey, of having a child on the spectrum?
Sure. The thing is, I think as a parent, you know, we like to think of our kids as being well-rounded. And with your autistic son or daughter, you almost have to go where they're at, right? Mm. So if they're totally into the Marvel universe or Pokemon or all these various, you know, media-centric interests that they have, like, embrace that and make learning about it. And that's what's unique about our program, is that they get to drive the project around, you know, all these really narrow, deep interests that they have. And when we pair them one-to-one with their design mentor, who we often match based on similar interests, like if somebody's interested in anime, you know, we'll pair them with a student who's interested in those types of things. And together, they'll geek out on that, right? So that engagement level is like super high, and then they're creating things together. So there's all this wonderful social interaction that happens through the creation of these projects.
Well, explain then how it works with a design mentor, how you pair them up, and what type of projects they do together.
Sure. We describe ourselves as an early intervention strengths-based program. So our kids are getting started really early, as young as age 8. And not only are they learning the software programs with their design mentor, but they're working on these really important social and emotional learning skills, which are, you know, really often the most difficult for autistic individuals to navigate. So the more they practice, the longer they practice, the higher likelihood of success. And we do it in such a way that those social skills are actually embedded into the project. So they're baked in, they don't even notice it. So we see that they're learning these skills, you know, in the course of creating these different projects. So the teams will spend, usually about 6 to 7 hours total collaborating on a design project during our workshops. And mentors aren't so much teaching software as they are helping students bring their vision to life. So they'll guide them with the proper tool selection and whatnot in order to achieve the look that they're looking for. And then the important things, like all of our students share their progress in a creative presentation at the end of the workshop. And that's a chance for everyone to celebrate the work that's being done. So the fact that we take time to celebrate makes us different and is really important because, you know, unfortunately, our students are not celebrated all that often and are not given credit for the capabilities and wonderful thinking and imagination that they have. So this act of celebration results in this increased self-confidence, you know, and all of us can identify with what a little boost of self-confidence can lead to. So when they're creating the projects that, you know, that might take the form of a printed poster or an animated sequence or a GIF, so they walk away with a tangible project that they can either put on their wall or they can, you know, post on the internet.
Well, you know, Mark, that workshops and group settings, a group environment can be very difficult to navigate with a child on the spectrum. So how do you approach that and make sure that the setting and the activity really fits the child and that these opportunities don't feel like, or the environment doesn't feel threatening?
That is a great question. A lot of our programming is virtual now, so students are participating at their home. But when we did the group workshops in person, people who'd come to visit would be in awe because they'd look around and see, you know, the students like super engaged and focused on what they are working on. So, you know, I think our perception is that, sensory, you know, we have to have sensory friendly areas for individuals with autism. And honestly, we have to set up an environment for their success. So if you put together, you know, the areas that we're working in, like the subject matter interest and the mentor to guide them, and technology is always a great level setter for our community. So we create this environment that has this energy and buzz to it, which is really amazing when we're all together in person. And then we spend a lot of time up front. We have what we call a concierge process. So our education team always does, it's generally a half hour call, it might be longer, with the parent to learn about how their student best learns. Like where are their strengths, where are their struggles, so that we know we have a great snapshot, a picture, so that we can set up that learning experience to be as successful as possible for them.
Mark Fairbanks with us, co-founder, executive director of Islands of Brilliance. This is a nonprofit providing learning experiences for children and young adults on the autism spectrum. Your experience with art and therapy, 800-642-1234. So you've received this grant, NEA grant, to create a research lab to further this work. What will the grant accomplish?
Yeah, we're so excited about this. So in November, we received word that the NEA had awarded UWM $150,000 for a one-year lab, which is renewable up to 5. So we're going to be looking at the use of creativity and creative technologies as an intervention that produces positive outcomes for the autistic students who participate in what we call our foundation level workshops. What we're excited about is this is going to result in academically published research on the outcomes of our core program offering, which we've been running for the past 10 years. So we've collected a lot of great stories and anecdotal evidence and things like that. But the chance to actually study this, Dr. Celeste Campos Castillo from UWM leading the research, is going to have a huge impact and a catalyst for us to have an even bigger, you know, impact on the autism community based on what comes out of this.
And when you say creative technologies, what programs, what technologies specifically are you talking about and are you using in Island of Brilliance?
Yeah, so for our foundation level workshops, which is what the NEA grant will study, we use Adobe Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator. We use a 3D program called Blender. Some of the students will also use a program called Procreate, which is more of an iPad-based creative technology. So that gives them the opportunity to kind of bring to life their ideas based on their interests. And you know, what's amazing is a lot of times they'll kind of mix and match and mash up, you know, interests together. So you'll get these really, you know, amazing creations. And I think that's what keeps our mentors coming back, is that they're just kind of blown away by how our students think.
I would imagine that this effort is difficult in a virtual format, though, when you have mentors working so closely with the student. How are you working through that?
You know, it was a challenge at first, but we had to pivot quickly to virtual just to stay connected with our community, because our community really needed us. But when you think about it, you know, you hear a lot about virtual learning and how it doesn't work for some students. And for many of our students, it worked really well. The reason being is that you have we use Zoom and we use Discord in our workshops. The student and the mentor were still like working on a screen in person, right? So now they're still working on a screen, they're just in different spots. And we use things like annotation so that mentors can, you know, point to tools and things like that. The other thing we've seen, which is really interesting, is the chat function in Zoom provides a different communication channel, which again levels a playing field for a student who may not be as verbal as some of their peers. So that's been pretty cool to see.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Mark Fairbanks, co-founder and executive director of Islands of Brilliance. We have a link at wpr.org/mornings. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Here's the weather forecast from Wisconsin Public Radio. Partly cloudy today, highs around 30. Windy tonight with a light snow developing, moving through the state overnight. And periods of light snow forecast for tomorrow, accumulations ranging from a few inches in the north to a dusting in the south. Windy too, highs on Friday in the 30s. And then much colder on Saturday with sunshine, but highs just in the single digits in the north to the teens in the south.
After 8 on the morning show, has our nation's high court become too political, too powerful? How could the Supreme Court of the United States be reformed? We talk with the director of the Constitution Project about what's on the table, along with your ideas. Next hour on the Ideas Network.
For anyone who's dated online, you'll know your love life is an easy way for tech giants to make money. Now, millions are turning to religious apps as a replacement for in-person worship. But it's not just their data that's being sold, it's their prayers too. We debate the problems tied to privacy, prayer, and profit. Next time on 1A.
This morning at 9 on the Ideas Network.
We're talking with candidates in the race to become Milwaukee's next mayor on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Seven candidates, they participated in a two-hour forum last night at Turner Hall. There's a virtual one tonight at 6, hosted by Sherman Park Community Association. Leads up to the nonpartisan primary election set for Tuesday, and the top two advance to the spring election on April 5th. What do you think Milwaukee's next mayor should prioritize? What are the city's biggest hurdles, and how should the mayor overcome them? 800-642-1234. Ernell Lucas is sheriff of Milwaukee County. Sheriff Lucas, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's begin with your top priorities for the city. What are they?
Well, certainly we have a crime, violent crime and reckless driving problem here in the city of Milwaukee that we've got to tackle. I say it's the key to our economic prosperity and our long-term viability, so we must solve that problem. Second, we got to get through the pandemic and keep our economy going and keep our schools open, keep everyone safe. We also have the problem with a lead pipe issue here in the city of Milwaukee, as well as lead paint in some of our older homes. So that's the health is a major challenge for our people. And then third, we certainly got to do something about our system of education here in the city of Milwaukee. I think it's so important that we give our young people the opportunity to reach their full potential. And it's so important, it's critically important. It underlies all of the issues, the other issues that we face here in the city of Milwaukee. So those would be the top three, I think, necessary for us to really focus in on as we move forward.
Well, starting with number one, as you say, crime and reckless driving, how would your administration seek to reduce the violence and the reckless driving?
Well, we've got to certainly work on, again, changing behaviors, changing people's approach to solving conflict. We've got to remove illegal guns from our street. We certainly have got to rid our community of drugs and gangs. And so it's going to be a comprehensive effort. We got to have law enforcement out doing what it is that we ask them to do. But then there's so many others in the community that play a part, whether it be the philanthropic community, the business community, faith-based community, community at large, so many other aspects. Our robust plan for violence prevention in the city of Milwaukee has got to be out, engaged with the community. And I think collectively, we all work together, and we can stem the tide of the rising violence that we see here in the city.
Police departments straight across the country, though, are raising concerns about staffing, the mass exodus of police officers, and some are pointing to COVID or the Great Resignation or the climate for law enforcement and the reforms. What approach would you take to staffing?
Well, it's certainly an issue that many employers have faced around the country, and it started long prior to COVID. I think we've got to highlight the fact that law enforcement and public service is a noble profession, and people enter into it because they want to do more for the community. And so many young people like myself came in at a time when our communities needed us and served long and rich and rewarding careers. We've now got to inspire a group of young people now to this profession because the urgency is there, and it stems from inspiring them to do something greater for the good of all in the community. And I think that that's where we really got to pick up our efforts.
Let's go to point number two in the pandemic. The city has about $200 million in unallocated federal funding for responding to the COVID pandemic. How should this money be spent?
Well, I say invest in three areas. One is certainly in health and public safety. And I say health, again, ensuring the total health of everybody in this community, from our young people, giving them the tools and the preparation they need to go into a classroom and compete later in life in a global market. We've got to, again, look out for our young people. Secondly, we got to look out for those seniors in our community and give them the health and safety that they need. The second area that I think is most important as well is quality of life. We've got to focus in on the quality of life issues here in the city of Milwaukee, whether it's the trash pickup, certainly the reckless driving that we've talked about previously, and other issues that impact the quality of life.
Well, I want to just jump in here because looking out for people in COVID is one thing, but how do you stop the spread? I mean, nearly half of the inmates in the Milwaukee County Jail contracted COVID last month as Omicron spread. What would be your approach to containing COVID, to handling this pandemic?
Well, we were certainly confronted by a challenge that many in this country were confronted by with the spread of COVID, with our population high in the jail and people entering into the jail already with the virus. We had to take steps to mitigate the virus at its high. There were several members of my staff, as well as a number of those persons in our care who were tested positive for the virus. as we sit here today, there's only five individuals in our jail who are COVID positive. So we took a number of steps to mitigate, whether it's, whether we quarantined individuals and kept individuals in single cells. And so, again, we took a number of steps to mitigate it. And where we are today is certainly in a lot better place than we were just a few short weeks ago.
Let me reintroduce you as we have conversations with all the candidates for Milwaukee mayor ahead of Tuesday's primary. The candidate today we're talking with is Milwaukee County Sheriff Ernell Lucas. You can join in with your questions on the mayoral race, your priorities, 800-642-1234. I want to look at the housing situation. We've been talking with mayors across Wisconsin about pressing issues. Housing is a uniform challenge. How should the city of Milwaukee support expanding affordable housing? What would your administration do?
Well, certainly the city must take steps to move a number of families and people here from occupants to home ownership. Certainly we've had problems along many lines here in this community, but I think it's important moving forward. The city has a large housing stock from the collapse of the housing market years ago. Cities should make investments in getting those homes improved and getting those homes back on the tax rolls and to families that need it in communities all across the city. We've got to have developments in all parts of the city that are affordable. And attract families to the city where they can earn living wage. And so we've got to be very strategic and very intentional in our approach to housing. I think it's one of the more racial injustice in our community that so many people are left without a home and a place to shelter. So many of our young people, and we've got to give them a roof over their head, and the city, I think, has to step up its efforts to do that.
What I'm hearing out of you is public health and equity issues, because in 2019, Milwaukee County passed a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. In the city, how would you take action to tackle inequalities?
Well, that's one of the things we want to come in on day one and do is bring people together. There's so much to celebrate here in Milwaukee, and yet we tend to focus on the things that divide us. We have an opportunity to move this city forward by bringing neighborhoods together, by bringing people together, and it's having a vision for all parts of the city. And as mayor, I'm going to do that and let it have us focus on the things that unite us and not the things that divide us. We're going to make opportunities for women and people of color to have opportunities to start businesses, to become employers that they can then help grow communities and neighborhoods. We're going to invest in, as you indicated, housing is so important for families to have that opportunity to start. We're going to give them health equity. That's another disparity here in our community. Even with COVID, it's disparate in terms of how the vaccines and other mitigation efforts were around the community from one community to another. So it's so important that, again, we look out for those in our community who have not had the opportunities to live to the fullest here in the city. And that's something that we're going to focus in on.
Sheriff Lucas, thank you for joining us.
I thank you so much.
Ernell Lucas is sheriff of Milwaukee County and on the ballot in Tuesday's primary. Join us tomorrow at 7:15 for our final Milwaukee mayor candidate conversation. And we have a growing collection of these candidate Q&As. You can find a link to them at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.